As Kyle Palmer just said, it's hot outside, and so are all the political races that are heating up all across Kansas and Missouri these days. Kansas City's race for mayor was upended this week with the news that Jason Kander is now trying to succeed Sly James. In Kansas, voters on both sides of the spectrum are going to have to think hard as they weigh their choices for the Democratic nominations for governor and Congress in the 3rd District, while Republicans have big decisions to make in their race for governor. July is almost here. The primaries in August, and as I said, the politics around here are heating up and may soon prove to be more interesting than professional baseball in this part of the country. The pundits today, Dave Helling of the editorial board of the Kansas City Star. David.
Great to be here.
Burdette Loomis is a political science professor at the University of Kansas. Bird.
Great to be here, Steve.
Eric Weston is with the Kansas City Call. Eric, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Eric,
can I come by and get one of those bomb pops?
You are welcome here anytime, as you know, Eric. Well, let's start with the race for mayor, Eric. Jason Kander shocked a lot of people by moving away from a bid for the White House to enter this very local race. Is the race over? Is Jason Kander our next mayor?
It kind of looks that way, but if you talk to Quentin Lucas, he's saying not so fast.
The city councilman who's also going to run, right?
Right. And he's saying that he's the only candidate that has crossover appeal, that can go into the black community, can go up north and get votes, and go to South Kansas City and the quarter and get votes. So he's going to be a stiff challenge for Jason. And then you got Scott Taylor with a ton of money saying, not so fast, I'm not out of the race yet.
Dave Helling, is the race over?
Well, Jason Kander is the front runner. I don't think you could find anyone who would deny that. But there's a long time between now and Election Day, so a lot of things can happen. Candidates will get into the race, perhaps. Some may drop out. We've got 9 candidates in the field now.
One dark horse who's not in, Catherine Shields.
Catherine Shields may run. That would make it an even 10. But let's just, I mean, Jason Kander, A, is a front runner because he's well known. But because he can also raise an enormous amount of money. Now, I did nationally. Now, I have heard some pushback from some people about his fundraising ability from outside of Kansas City who say, look, there may be Kander supporters who are less than enthralled with this decision, primarily because they saw him as a sort of a get-out-the-vote guy and a potential White House candidate, and they're not going to be eager to write a $500 check for Jason Kander to run for mayor. So it may be he may have a tougher time raising money from out of the city than you would imagine. But, you know, the corporate community, donors in Kansas City will understand quickly that he's in the top tier the day he announced. So I don't think money is going to be an issue. We'll just have to see how the campaign plays out.
Eric Weston, how surprised were you that Jolie Justice, who had been the front runner in the Kraske power rankings that were written up in the Kansas City Star, dropped out so quickly and endorsed her friend Jason Kander? That surprised you?
Yeah, it really did. I was really surprised by that. I thought that, you know, she had Sly's team working on her campaign, and I thought she was going to make that push, but then suddenly she drops out, throws her support behind Jason, and is being a good friend, so it's interesting. But you had made a comment earlier, and Dave had made a comment about raising money. Is it enough money to go around the 9 candidates, possibly 10, in this mayoral race? Because that's a lot of checks that will be written.
Yeah.
Right, and the argument would be no, and so some lesser candidates who have a hard time raising money may decide 3-6 months from now it's just not worth the effort. But I do think that because of the interesting nature of the nonpartisan part of the mayoral campaign, that candidates can see themselves, if not beating Jason Kander in the primary, finishing second, which is all you have to do. You need to get into the runoff.
Right.
That wouldn't take a lot of money, and you could see the sort of middle-level candidate saying, you know, I need 7,000-8,000 votes.
Right.
I could get that and then take my chances against Jason Kander. So my guess is the field won't thin out dramatically, But Kander is still, and I think, Eric, you would agree, as we sit here today, is clearly the front runner, and it's a race for second place, and we'll see how that plays out.
David, you pointed out in your column this week, and maybe this is a way to wrap up the mayoral segment of our pundits panel here, that we're seeing this generational shift now in Kansas City politics. This really is something of an interesting moment.
Yes, it is. And what I was trying to point out is not just with the mayor's race, but with all the leaders, Steve, that you and I covered when we were younger people. The Emmanuel Cleavers, the Kay Barnes, the Dick Berkeleys, they're leaving the scene. There's just no other way to put it. Obviously, Emmanuel Cleaver is still a candidate, but by and large, that leadership group, which we knew and reported on, is moving on, and you are turning to a younger cohort of candidates. Five of the candidates in the mayor's race now are under the age of 40. Hmm. Kansas City hasn't elected someone under the age of 40 as mayor since 1912.
Wow. Mm.
And so it shows some change that younger people are now moving up into leadership roles in Kansas City, and the old guard is moving away.
I want to shift gears now, move over to Kansas, and take a look at the 3rd District race, where a scrum of Democrats are vying for the right to take on Kevin Yoder. Burnett Lewis, how do you see it?
Scrum. It's a scrum.
It's a scrum.
I mean, you got it. And we could almost leave it there. We won't, of course. But I think that political scientists and pundits and journalists were burned so badly in 2016. Yeah. The idea of having any kind of prediction on this is pretty much ridiculous. This is a turnout race. Who can get their people to the polls? And I'm not sure everyone in that race can make a convincing argument, but 3 or 4 of the candidates, I think, can say, if X and Y fall into place, I can get my people to the polls, and I can win this maybe with 27, 26, 25% of the vote.
You know, it strikes me, Bird, that voters are going to have to spend some time sorting through these people, because the differences between them, I've had them all in here now, aren't dramatic. They're all Democrats with fairly traditional Democratic positions.
Right.
So they're going to have to think about this a little
bit.
Yeah,
I mean, you do have the labor guy from Wyandotte, the Native American woman, the former school teacher. You know, it's like it's a game of Clue with all these, you know, but when you get their positions together, they're not that much different. I think the crucial thing here, and I think it looks that this is happening, is they all agree that the day after the primary, they're on the same page, and they will support the winner of the primary election, and that's the only way that the Democrats will come up with a viable general election campaign.
You know, David Helling, it's interesting to me that these candidates, they're all first timers.
Every single one of them on
the Democrats.
As Bird was talking, that's exactly the thought I have. The thing they share is an utter lack of legislative or really electoral politics experience, right? They haven't run before.
Will that be an advantage? One of them's got to run against Kevin Yoder. That'll be an advantage?
No, I think by August 8th, all of the candidates will have some sense of what needs to be done. And as Bird points out, there will be some sort of unity meeting. And so I don't think that will be an issue. And we're seeing this dynamic play out all over the country, because you're getting new people on the Democratic side, particularly entering these races. It may be harder for the general election public to get a sense of where a Democratic candidate might be than, say, Kevin Yoder. Kevin Yoder's name is extraordinarily well known, of course, in the 3rd District.
Right.
So I've said for some time that I think what the Democrat needs in the 3rd District is a wave election, a sense of such anger and frustration with the Trump White House primarily that Republicans across the country are swamped. And if that happens, I think Kevin Yoder is in trouble. Absent that, though, and absent just an enormous amount of money on the Democratic side, I think Yoder remains the slight favorite today.
Eric Wesson, do you sense this is a Democratic wave election? Are folks on the east side of Kansas City, are African Americans energized and fired up and ready to go to the polls this year?
No. Hmm. No. They'll come out and support Representative Cleaver, but I think as far as any of the other candidates, is kind of lukewarm. You know, the base hasn't really connected, gone after those Democrats who are registered but haven't voted, going after that non that non-traditional voting bloc, and I think that that's going to really, really be a factor in how they connect with that base and get them out to the polls, because there's no candidate that's exciting enough to get them out to the polls to do any of that.
Burnett Loomis, do you sense a big blue wave coming this November?
I'd say it will be something between a ripple, a blue ripple, and a pretty big wave. And okay, I don't think we really know. But I here's what I'm taking away from a lot of these elections is to nationalize this right now is really foolish. I think you have to go district by district. And Dave's analysis just now, I think, is quite right. Kevin Yoder's a pretty known quantity. If there's a medium-sized wave, the demographics of that district are such that Yoder's in trouble. You look at the second district in Kansas, Paul Davis, probably a slight favorite right now because Republicans simply can't get their act together. And it's a very different district. And you'll see this. You saw Joe Crowley lose the other night, a very specific district. So I think that what we're seeing, and again, Dave said this, is a bottom-up. And you're getting a lot of candidates, and we don't know how good they are. I would say there's a great series recently, a podcast on 1994, 2006, 2010 wave elections. And I think the conclusion was that we really don't know where we are right now.
What's interesting is we sit here today, there's a possibility that come November, we might have two of the four Kansas congressional seats held by Democrats.
Right.
We haven't had that since the days of Jim Slattery and Dan Glickman.
Right. But let's be clear. The one part of the equation which Burns points out is energy on the Democratic side and enthusiasm and how that might contribute to a wave. But the other part of that is Republican dissatisfaction with the Trump White House. Now, that isn't going to be a problem in some places, like in western Kansas. In the first district, that won't be a problem. But in the third district of Kansas,
Johnson and Wyandotte counties,
which Hillary Clinton carried in 2016
by a single point,
the bar for Donald Trump is interesting, and to the extent that Republicans in November are discouraged in terms of voting for Kevin Yoder, then that might give the Democrat a 1 or 2 point boost on the other side. So I guess what I'm arguing is district by district, you need to measure more than just Democratic enthusiasm, but rather Republican frustration with the White House, which I think is very real in districts like the third, suburban districts, highly educated, and had a predisposition to go for the Democrat anyway.
We're visiting with our political pundits this morning, Dave Helling from The Star, KU's Burnett Loomis, The Call's newspaper's Eric Wesson. Just to check in with the Missouri U.S. Senate race, Josh Hawley, Claire McCaskill running for the U.S. Senate as if it's already October. Eric, these races are starting earlier than ever, earlier than I've ever seen in my reporting career. Are you seeing the same thing?
Yes, and Claire had an upswing once Greitens stayed in office, but then after he came out of office and resigned, it kind of fizzled down, and I think she'll get an upswing with the separating the kids from their parents with the immigration issue. She might be able to get an upswing with that as long as President Trump doesn't keep saying, hey, this is the Democrats' fault, and then she has to go on the defensive rather than be on the offensive. But I don't remember the race coming out this early either.
Bert, speaking of upswings, you can't help but wonder about yesterday's announcement about Anthony Kennedy stepping down. Does that give Republicans an upswing that maybe wasn't anticipated until roughly this time yesterday?
I mean, I think the question there is, will Mitch McConnell move this through before Election Day or not? And my guess is that they find someone, a Gorsuch type, and put him through as quickly as possible. Because the problem there is that if you waited till after the election and somehow the Democrats got control of the Senate, there would be an immense blowback, and the Republicans would be faced with a much more difficult task of confirming a justice. If you had Murkowski and Collins just say, no, you know, we're gonna wait till the next Congress. So I think that McConnell's in the driver's seat here, mm-hmm. and nothing that I've seen contradicts the idea that he'll use his power to confirm a justice pretty quickly.
David, I'm not in the habit of giving advice to candidates or campaigns, but
you wouldn't hesitate.
But I wouldn't hesitate in this forum to do so. We started out this conversation talking about Jason Kander, who almost beat Roy Blunt, as we know, in 2016. And he's got a new book coming out, which I had a chance to page through yesterday. And he talked a little bit about his campaign night, you know, the election night, in which they all believed they were going to win because the early signs from Springfield, rural Missouri, he was doing great. Turnout was exceeding expectations, and they were getting their acceptance speech ready. And then he underperformed dramatically in Kansas City and St. Louis, more St. Louis than Kansas City. It is absolutely key for Claire McCaskill to not only carry the two urban areas, but do so dramatically with a lot of people going to the polls. Now, my guess is that St. Louis and Kansas City voters are less focused maybe on abortion in terms of the Kennedy replacement than they might be, for example, on affirmative action or equal rights. So to the extent that Claire can make the case that the court has an impact on cities, she might be able to use that to increase turnout and do a better job against Josh Hawley than maybe Kander did against Blunt. That's an outside, you know, shot, but it may be the only shot she has because, and I think Eric would agree with this, the enthusiasm for Claire McCaskill in the inner city simply isn't there.
But Eric Weston, just to come back to you, the distance between where we stand today and a big blue wave on the east side of Kansas City, which would be critical if you know, you'd have to see a lot of enthusiasm there to say there's a big blue wave happening. You're saying we ain't even close yet.
No, we're not even close yet. And I think Dave is right. And if you get to the Voting Rights Act and the things that people in the urban core can relate to and understand, I think that would help create it. Because if Trump gets to appoint another Supreme Court justice, we're in a world of trouble in a lot of areas. And in the black community, one of those areas is affirmative action and voting rights and civil rights issues. So if she could connect onto that and make a platform based upon those issues that people in the urban core understand, she might get a little ripple. I'm not saying it's going to be a tidal wave, but she might get a little ripple and get some conversation and buzz about support, because right now she doesn't have it.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to turn to Kansas Governor, both Democrats and Republicans. And in the meantime, I want to thank Eric Weston from The Call for joining us today. Eric,
thank
always
you so
appreciate
much for
it.
Having
yeah,
me.
You bet.
All right. Take care.
Let's turn to Republicans in Kansas, Burdette Loomis. There's this big battle royale in the fight for the nomination for governor. It's Jeff Collier versus Kris Kobach. At least that's what it seems to be out there. A few other candidates sort of thrown into the mix. Is that how it strikes you?
Right now, absolutely. I think that you have Jim Barnett and Ken Seltzer in there. But certainly, the big fight is on the right-hand side of the Republican Party between Governor Collier and Secretary of State Kris Kobach.
Those folks tend to turn out at primaries. More moderate Republicans don't tend to show up. So who seems to have the edge right now? Can
Boy,
you tell?
You don't get into predictive business on this one. I think the polling data are not very good. You see a couple polls with Kobach up. Collier might have been up a couple points in another poll. But what's fascinating here is Kobach, of the two, the Secretary of State, is by far the better-known candidate, the known quantity. Collier has an add-up that's just incredible to me, that is introducing himself in the end of June as the governor of Kansas. He's been governor for 5 months, and he's now introducing himself as governor, which I think tells you maybe it's about money, but it's also this is not a guy with a lot of charisma, a lot of natural political skill. And there you got Kobach with a lot of charisma, a lot of other stuff, a lot of baggage. I just don't know. Certainly Kobach, what's fascinating about Kobach is there is no movement toward, even moderately moving toward the center. He is cast every bit of his campaign in going as far right as he possibly can.
On the Democratic side, Dave Helling, we've got another scrum, to use a word from earlier in this show. We got Josh Swatty. We've got Laura Kelly in the race. We've got Carl Brewer, the former mayor of Wichita. What are you seeing?
Well, I don't think – I mean, Carl Brewer is, excuse me, an impressive candidate, but he's not gaining much traction. Maybe in Wichita. I don't have really a good sense of that, but it doesn't appear that there's a big groundswell for Carl. That leaves Josh Svati and Laura Kelly. I had coffee this week with an extraordinarily well-known local businessman with an interest in Kansas politics who's very much for Laura Kelly. And he told me that Kathleen Sebelius is really working to get her numbers up, and the whole sort of Sebelius machinery is interested in promoting her candidacy. But you don't get a sense that there's electricity there at all. Now, I think it's unfair to hold Laura Kelly to some standard that she's going to light up the world with her personality or whatever. That's not what we really need in a governor, and that's not part of the job description, although it's helpful in a campaign context. But there is a concern that the generational thing we talked about for the mayor's race may also apply in Josh Vadi's case, and the Democrats may well go for that. The other thing I've said is this. Josh Vadi has some problems on abortion with sort of mainstream Democrats.
Right.
But Laura Kelly has some problems on guns
right.
for mainstream Democrats. And there may be a balancing act for some voters on the Democratic side as to which is more important. And that may be, you know, what decides that race.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there, gentlemen. Our political pundits panel, Dave Helling from the Kansas City
great
Star. Burdette Loomis from the KU
Thanks,
Political
Steve.
Science Department. Always great to have you guys. Time for a break. We're going to, when we come back, we're going to talk about automating inequality when it comes to America's poor. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, former Kansas Secretary of Agriculture Josh Svati joins us to talk about his bid for the governor's office. We were just talking about Josh. Yesterday in the show, we discussed why Missouri's maternal mortality rates are on par with some third world countries. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, the poor in this country are under surveillance. The new tools available in the computer age means the poor can be tracked in terms of where they go and what they buy. Automated eligibility systems discourage them from claiming resources they need to survive, and they are tagged electronically as high-risk individuals and problematic parents. Who gets food? Who starves? Who gets housing? Who remains homeless? The digital revolution decides all and keeps the poor always at arm's length. Virginia Eubanks writes about this in her new book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile Police and Punish the Poor. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Albany, SUNY, and she speaks in town this afternoon. It's so nice to have you here, Virginia. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited for the conversation.
Let's go slow here because I want our listeners to grasp what you're talking about. You were shocked one day when you were talking to a woman named Dorothy Allen, who was a young mother on welfare, about her experiences with welfare technology. What did she tell you that surprised you so much?
Yeah, so I come to this work from a long background in community technology center movements. And so I spent a lot of my 20s and 30s working with communities to build technological resources to, you know, what at the time we called bridging the digital divide.
Right.
And a great sort of learning moment, turning moment for me came when I was helping to build a tech lab at a residential YWCA in my hometown of Troy, New York. And I was sitting in the lab with one of the folks who lived at the Y. She goes by a pseudonym in the book, Dorothy Allen. And we were having a conversation about technology just kind of broadly or just kind of shooting the breeze. And at one point, I asked her about her electronic benefits transfer card, her EBT card. Those are the sort of debit-like cards that you get public benefits on.
That's how you
on.
Get your money. Yeah.
Yeah, if you get SNAP benefits or you get child care credits, right, that go on this card.
Right.
And I was asking Dorothy, I was saying, you know, people tell me that you know, this is more convenient. There's maybe less stigma in the grocery store because you look like everyone else with this debit card. And she said, oh, yeah, that's all true. There's some things about it that are really great. But also, my caseworker uses it as a way to track all of my spending and all of my movements. And I must have had this super shocked look on my face because she just kind of pointed and laughed at me for about 2 minutes.
Big brother, big sister, they're watching.
Yeah. And then she kind of got quiet and she said, oh, Virginia, like you all, meaning professional middle class people, you all should pay attention to what's happening to us because they're coming for you next. Hmm. And that conversation happened almost 20 years ago now, in the year 2000. And so I really have kept Dorothy's voice in my head for the last 20 years as I've sort of researched and written about technology and public benefits in the United States.
So how was Dorothy's buying habits being used in her conversations with her caseworker?
So her caseworker would, she'd go into meetings with her caseworker, and her caseworker would say things like, why are you buying groceries at the corner store? You should be going to the grocery store. You'd save money. And this is, I mean, Dorothy's not, it was poor. She wasn't stupid. Right. So she knew fully well where she could get the best prices on things. But there were other kinds of constraints in her life that made going to the corner store make more sense. Right? Maybe the bus doesn't run to the grocery store on Sunday nights. Or maybe it's actually not entirely safe to walk back from the grocery store with a bunch of groceries, you know, 80 blocks. Yeah. And so she knows her own life. And she felt like those conversations were really focused on punishing her for choices that people didn't entirely understand.
And this was 20 years ago, so you can only imagine how much more closely monitored the poor are today. What did you find?
Yeah, so that's what the book is. It's exactly what the book is about. So in Automating Inequality, I talk about three different cases. The first is about an attempt to automate all of the eligibility processes for the welfare programs in the state of Indiana. And that happened in around 2006. The second case I talk about was piloted in 2013. That's a system called the Coordinated Entry System
in Los Angeles,
County. It's been talked about as its proponents by its proponents as the Match.com of homeless services. And the intention of the system is to match the most vulnerable unhoused people with the most appropriate available resources.
So there are good intentions in some of these cases, but it's good intentions gone wrong in many cases.
Yes.
Right?
So let's talk. Let me tell you about the third case.
The third one is in Allegheny
County. And then let's talk about intentions.
It's in New York. It sounds like a science fiction movie. It started with a team in New Zealand who wanted to predict child abuse and neglect before a child is born. How did that shake out?
Yeah, so the Allegheny County case is a tool called the Allegheny Family Screening Tool. And Allegheny County is where Pittsburgh is. And the Allegheny Family Screening Tool is a predictive model that's supposed to be able to forecast which children might be victims of abuse or neglect
in
the future.
This is in Pennsylvania, not New York.
Yes, thank you.
Pennsylvania. I said New York.
That's okay. From the point of view of both frontline caseworkers in that system and families who feel like they're being targeted by that system, folks have a lot of concerns. We don't actually know how that's going to turn out. It is ongoing right now. They just launched it in August of 2016. But there's definitely some things to be thoughtful, critical, and concerned about in that case.
There really is a sense that again, Big Brother isn't only watching, but Big Brother is really intruding here in people's lives.
Yeah, so I think for folks who haven't had experience of public services that are aimed primarily at poor and working people in this country, the level of intrusion that those systems have always had across history in people's lives can be really hard to understand.
That's one of your points. This goes back
a long way. Yeah. So I use this metaphor actually in the book of the digital poorhouse, that with some of these tools, despite often very good intentions, and despite the fact that sort of new database systems could really lower barriers and speed results for people, because of these sort of deep ideas we have about poverty in the United States, we're building what amounts to a digital poorhouse.
And we have these ideas of poverty because we believe so deeply in this country that, there is no free lunch, that when you get these benefits, maybe there's a little bit of an obligation attached to it coming back the other way?
Yeah, so I think what we tend to believe in this country is that receiving any kind of public assistance requires trading your other basic rights. Right. So, and this is, I believe, all based in this kind of crazy story we have in the United States about poverty, that poverty is an aberration, that it's something that only happens to a small percentage of probably pathological people. But the reality, based on Mark Rank's really incredible life cycle work around poverty, the reality in this country is 51% of us will be below the poverty line at some point in our adult lives. Mm-hmm. And a full two-thirds of us will access means-tested public assistance. That's straight welfare. That's not reduced price school lunches. That's not Social Security. That's straight welfare. So poverty is actually a majority issue in the United States. So these ideas we have about, like, we have to sift through folks to see who's moral enough for help or who's deserving enough for help are really crazy ideas. And I believe they waste time, they waste money, they waste resources that we could use building a universal floor under us all rather than building these increasingly sophisticated moral thermometers that basically ask you, is your poverty your own fault?
But a lot of politicians would say, though, Virginia, that we owe it to our taxpayers to do all this, mm-hmm. because the last thing we want to see is this money being wasted or abused or even fraud intersecting with the system somehow.
Sure. Inefficiency and fraud happen in any large organization, and we should absolutely pay attention to it. It's particularly an issue in Medicaid in some ways that are really important to keep an eye on, although I have to say most fraud in Medicaid is provider fraud, not consumer fraud. So it's actually fraud by doctors and medical practices, not fraud by clients. But I believe that, and let's talk about specifics here because it makes it much more concrete. So in Indiana, the case in Indiana that I talk about, identifying fraud and weeding out ineligible people was very much part of the conversation about why Indiana should shift to automated eligibility processes. In practice, fine. Like, that could lower barriers for folks. That could make resources more available to people who really need them. In reality, what happened is the governor signed a $1.34 billion contract with a consortium of high-tech companies that included IBM and ACS. The contract was so focused on identifying fraud and curtailing ineligible recipients that it kicked it denied 1 million applications for wow. public assistance in the first 3 years of the experiment. That was a 54% increase from the 3 years before the experiment.
And maybe one motivation here was to find ways to save money. And if that was the case, this sure worked.
Well, yeah, so again, we're getting back to that intentions question. It's a really interesting question. I think the most important thing to say about, I don't know what was in Governor Mitch Daniels' heart, but I can say that if they were trying to build a system that denied people their fair share of our shared resources, they couldn't have built a better system if they were doing it on purpose. So Chris Hawley, a Medicaid attorney I spoke to in Bloomington, Indiana, was really clear about this. He said, look, we have at least philosophically in our criminal justice system the idea that it's better that 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person remain in jail. And Chris said, what we did here in Indiana was flip that on its
yes.
head.
Yes.
Is that we said it's better for 10 eligible people to be denied the basic resources they need to survive and thrive than it is for one ineligible person to receive them. And I think that's a fundamental challenge to our values and our constitutional protections around things like due process.
We're talking about how technology is being used to keep closer track on the nation's poor. My guest is Virginia Eubanks. Her new book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. She'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the 2018 Excellence in Nonprofit Leadership Awards. This takes place at Rockhurst University. More information, 2018 ENLA.evanbright.com. You can go see and hear Virginia this afternoon. Well, in this Indiana system, a lot of people, when they got these denial of service letters, they just assumed, what, the system knew best here, right?
Yeah, and that's an interesting, that the computer's always right is an interesting sort of cultural idea that we have. So what happened in Indiana is they moved 1,500 public caseworkers who used to work in local county offices to these private call centers, regionalized call centers, often hundreds of miles away from where folks lived and where they knew about the community. And there were these rather than being responsible for a caseload of families, whether being accountable for their case from beginning to end, the newly privatized caseworkers were responsible to a queue of tasks that dropped into their workflow management system. And that meant that every call came from somebody new. Every time as a applicant, you called into the call center, you talked to a new person. So it became really, really hard to figure out what had gone wrong if something right. went wrong in this incredibly complicated, you know, 34 to 60 page application for public services.
Right.
And what that meant is that people who were applying received these letters called failure to cooperate letters, failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility. And all that meant is that a mistake had been made somewhere. Like it could be that you didn't provide us a document or you forgot to sign page 16. It could be that when you faxed your driver's a copy of your driver's license into the document center where they scanned it, it just turned black because it had been copied, faxed, then scanned, and it couldn't be read. It could be that the computer system or the call center operator made a mistake, but the notices didn't say what had gone wrong. Mm-hmm. It just said something had gone wrong, and that the system interpreted something going wrong as an intentional failure to comply with the dictates of the system, and that was enough evidence to kick you off, to deny you public assistance or kick you off
assistance. Tough. That's really tough.
And so let me just tell you one story. One of the stories I tell in the book is about this woman, Omega Young, who's a middle-aged African-American woman who was unable to make a call center recertification appointment for Medicaid because she was in the hospital suffering from terminal cancer, from ovarian cancer. She actually called the office. She called the call center to let them know that she couldn't make it because she was actively in the hospital. They sent her a failure to cooperate letter and they kicked her off her Medicaid. Mm. Because she couldn't, she didn't lost her Medicaid. She also lost her food stamps, her free rides to medical transportation, to medical appointments. She struggled to pay for medications. And she died on March 1st, 2009, I believe. And the very next day, she actually won a fair hearing about her eligibility. The court said, or the administrative law judge said, actually, they made a mistake. You've been eligible all along. And they recertified her for all of her benefits the day after she died.
That hurts. Mm-hmm. I've got less than a minute left. What should the takeaway be from all this? What do you hope comes out of your book?
Well, I hope we have a better conversation about the way we're building these technologies. We have a tendency to think of them as neutral and objective, but they actually have this sort of deep social programming built into them about who we value, what we believe we deserve, and how we care for each other. And so I really think we need to stop building these tools in neutral and start building them for the world we actually live in.
That's Virginia Eubanks, her new book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. Interesting stuff. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yesterday on the show, ACLU leaders from Kansas and Missouri caught us up on some of their latest activities, including a recent federal court ruling against Chris Kobach. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, more from the Kansas gubernatorial candidates. It's time for another Democrat, Josh Swatty, who was elected to the Kansas House at the age of 22. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.